One of the first areas of cuts is mental health funding. After the Great Recession, 32 states and the District of Columbia made cuts to their mental health budgets. Because mental health services have traditionally been paid for out of state general revenues, the impact of the downturn in the economy has been more devastating on these services than to other social safety net services for general health care. State general funds, which are administered by state mental health authorities, represent 40% of total state support for mental health services. Medicaid, meanwhile, makes up the other 46%. And although the federal government allocates money to support mental health care in the states, federal spending on public health has been eroded through funding cuts and budget caps. Funding local mental health and substance use disorder programs and services has been and will continue to be an ongoing challenge. However, over the past few years, state legislatures have been empowering counties and municipalities to create their own revenue, whether through a local sales tax or property tax or millionaire's tax. So some state and local governments have begun taking matters into their own hands, enacting tax increases to fund these pivotal mental health services. For example, in Laramie County, Colorado, voters passed a 0.25% tax increase, which is generating $80 million over the course of 5 years to fund behavioral health services. In Scott County, Iowa, they have dedicated mental health and disability services fund for which the primary source of revenue is a property tax. The vast majority of counties in Ohio, all but 12 of 88, have adopted some form of property tax levy to support mental health services. And in Chicago, 74% of voters approved an add-on property tax to fund community mental health services. These are just a few examples of localities taking it upon themselves to increase fiscal resources to mental health. Today, we will hear from four different perspectives on how various cities, counties, and states have taken matters into their own hands to create dedicated funding streams to help enhance access to mental health care. We are lucky to be joined today by representatives from the City of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the City of Denver, Colorado, King County, Washington, and the State of California on how they have taken it upon themselves to create new forms of funding for mental health services and facilities. I hope our call gives you some insight into some of the ways localities and organizations are innovating and leading on this issue, with the hopes of giving you strategies to replicate certain approaches in your own communities. We have a great slate of speakers today, beginning with Jared Himowitz. Jared serves as the director of the Mayor's Healthy City Initiative in the City of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Jared will be discussing the City of Baton Rouge's recently enacted mental health property tax. For some quick background, the City Council authorized a new tax for a period of 10 years to be used entirely and exclusively for the purpose of operating and maintaining a treatment center that will provide critical mental health and substance abuse services. And to give us a deep dive into this, I now hand the floor over to Jared. And Jared, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Walt. I really appreciate it. For everybody on the call, Walt sent out a PowerPoint presentation that I'm going to walk through. So if you're a visual learner, you can kind of follow along with me there. If not, he'll probably send it out again, and then also my email address and phone number. And so please don't hesitate to reach out if you have any questions. So again, my name is Jared Himowitz. I'm the director of the Mayor's Healthy City Initiative here in Baton Rouge. And so one of the unique things about Baton Rouge and really Louisiana is we don't have local health departments. So in Louisiana, we have a decentralized local control. And so we rely on the state for their health department, and they look at the state through a regional approach. So we're located in Region 2. It's us and six other parishes, which we call counties here in Louisiana. And so New Orleans is actually the only municipality with their own health department. And so my role in the mayor's office is to do kind of health in all policies. And so I advocate for on behalf of health in different conversations like complete streets, housing, infrastructure, different policies like needle exchanges, smoke-free, things like that. And then at the same time, the mayor in-kinds my salary to a nonprofit. So I run a 501c3 nonprofit out of the mayor's office, and we have 17 CEOs that sit on our board. So the mayor president, she sits on the board. Our board chair is the VP of mission at the largest hospital system. All five local nonprofit hospitals CEOs sit on our board. the chief medical director for the State Health Department, Pennington Biomedical Research Center, which is a partnership with Louisiana State University, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Louisiana, which is the largest private insurer in our state, the CEO of the Louisiana Primary Care Association, which oversees all of the federally qualified health centers, our health district here, as well as the chamber, the foundation, our recreation department, the school system, and Capital Area United Way. So there are 17 CEOs that sit on our board. Now our mission is to communicate, collaborate, and coordinate to make Baton Rouge a healthier place for all. And so what we do is we actually write something called a community health needs assessment. So every health department, as well as every nonprofit hospital, has to write a community health needs assessment, or a CHNA. And so on the slide, it kind of talks about what the CHNA goes through. So it's an advisory group. They collect data, they analyze it, they develop this report, and then they disseminate that information. And so in 2012, 2015, and 2018, behavioral health was one of the four significant health needs for our community, as identified by the joint community health needs assessments that all five competing hospitals put out. And so we are, in essence, a collective impact model. We have one full-time staff person, which is myself, and then two people that are brought on through grants to help support the work that we do. And we use the community health needs assessments to drive this collective impact model. So there are over 100 organizations and over 400 individual members that are a part of Healthy BR. And so that just kind of gives you a little bit of background. And so for those municipalities that are on the call right now, if you don't have a local health department or you have a small municipality, there are ways that you can leverage the hospitals and other stakeholders to do this similar work. And what I'll kind of walk through with the Bridge Center is how we leverage different partners that you may not think about to help get this initiative passed. So a little bit of background. We used to have a charity hospital or a public health hospital here, and the previous governor closed that down in 2013. At that hospital, there was something called an MHER, the Mental Health Emergency Room Extension. And in essence, it was a place that first responders, so EMS, fire, BRPD, and sheriff, were able to drop off people who were struggling with substance abuse, and they were able to have a detox and a place for them to stay instead of taking them to jail or taking them to the ERs. When that closed down and we didn't have a local hospital anymore, they were starting to look at how we can fill that void, because we saw that the first responders were having to interact with people who may be better served with behavioral health services rather than prison or jail. And so we went and looked at the Restoration Center in San Antonio, Texas, and there's a link in the presentation. And we looked at kind of what are they doing there and how could we potentially bring that here to Baton Rouge. And so what happened at that same time frame was there was a wealthy benefactor whose son committed suicide in jail. And so he felt so passionate about not having the behavioral health services necessary to save his son that he dedicated funds with our area foundation to help explore how this can never happen to another child again. And so through that funding mechanism, as well as some other federal grants and other stakeholders, they started the Bridge Center. So the Bridge Center is kind of a mobile assessment. So there's going to be a team that will initially go out with the first responders, but then soon can go out in place of first responders to assess if somebody has a mental health challenge and how they can support that person. So right now, there's over 600 calls where first responders are going, and they're labeling that as a mental health call, not as an emergency or as a criminal call. And so this will help kind of fill that void of utilizing mental health professionals rather than using police officers. But at the same time, we still know that there are still going to be police officers that are going to be addressing people with behavioral health challenges. And so there will be an entrance on the back end of this or of this entity where it'll be a 5 to 7 minute drop off. So in essence, they can take somebody and drop them off and they can get back onto the street patrolling and protecting the citizens within 5 to 7 minutes, rather than currently they have to go to the ER, they have to drop the person off, they have to be seen, and then they have to be released from custody to the hospital, or sometimes they even have to stay with the patient at the hospital. So again, it's this, if you're seeing the thread, it's really around public safety and the interconnectedness of public health and public safety. So someone will come in to the front door and no one will be turned away, and that's what our tax pays for. And then they'll be triaged. So if they need to go to sobering, they can go to sobering. If they need to go to respite, they'll have respite. There'll also be a medical detox and acute psych. And so there'll be 18 beds in each of these four areas. They will first be given kind of observation for up to 23 hours, where they'll then decide, do they go to the mental health section or the substance abuse section? And then what's great is that they'll actually follow up for the next 10 to 14 days following respite, up to 30 days around case management, to ensure that the person, when they are released from the Bridge Center, is getting into primary care, outpatient treatment centers, and housing and transportation, and kind of those social determinants of health. So let's go a little bit deeper into kind of the history of this. So 2016, the ballot initiative actually failed. So they put it on the ballot and the citizens voted it down. And so they went back and said, okay, what do we need to do? Well, the following year, our governor was elected, and the first thing he did was expand Medicaid here in Louisiana. Then the Area Foundation, which I talked about, was kind of that backbone support system, hired a consultant to look at what will this look like if we have the cost savings. And from that, they put out a new ballot initiative for 10 years, a 1.5 mil property tax, which is estimated to raise around $6 million a year over the next 10 years. So who are the partners in the Bridge Center? So it was the John D. and Catherine MacArthur Foundation, which received funding, the Urban Institute, the Mayor's Office, the District Attorney and the Public Defender's Office, the Sheriff, the courts, the city courts, Bridge Center for Hope, which is the nonprofit running this, the LSU School of Social Work, and community service providers. So really looking at this from a holistic picture of both law enforcement and public health. So why did it work this time? There was a coordination and collaboration that did not exist the first time. We were able to bring in private and public entities to come together on this one issue, and they went through the whole swath of law enforcement. So the sheriff, the DA, the public defender, the warden, the coroner, all went out and spoke to the public about the need for this. We also had the hospitals and other behavioral health providers providing examples of why this was important. And so they engaged the holistic healthcare community. And then finally, they engaged philanthropy. And so they really understood the importance that philanthropy plays in this role to help solidify the funding up front to get to the tax. And so I gave a link to the website for the Bridge Center if you want to learn more. But with that, I will turn it over to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jared. So I'll kick things off here with a question. If you have a question on the line, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. So give the folks a second to think of any questions. But Jared, I just want to go back to that point on the 2016 after it, the ballot initiative failed the first time. What, you know, I know you said obviously you had a change in leadership statewide, but can you go talk a little bit about like what you guys did, if there are any lessons you learned or any new approaches you guys took to make sure that it was successful the second time around?
Sure. So I think that the partners who were part of the first ballot initiative took for granted that people would just buy in. So there wasn't really a coordinated campaign. There wasn't a plan. It was more of, we did some press, we put it on the ballot, and we just assumed that the constituents would vote for it. And in Louisiana, we are very adverse to voting on taxes, and so it did not pass. What's interesting, though, is that in this same ballot that the Bridge Center was passed, we also passed our MoveEBR, our infrastructure and roads program, which is a $1 trillion project. So we really had two once-in-a-lifetime ballots actually pass at the same time in the Deep South. And so it really can be done if the right messaging and partners are championing the project.
Super. Any questions on the line for Jerry? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Give the folks a second. And then, Jared, one more from me. What advice would you give? Obviously, you know, Baton Rouge is not the biggest city in the world, but what advice would you give to, you know, smaller municipalities who are looking to do something similar to what you guys have done?
Sure. So I think it's, you know, go around the country, find best practices, look at what's working, what's not working, and then bring the right stakeholders to get together. What we do really well here in Baton Rouge, especially through Healthy BR, is bringing a diverse group of stakeholders together around one mission and vision. And so reach out to folks that you may not think will typically agree with this, because you would be surprised how behavioral health is really accepted through a diverse political spectrum and also a diverse ethical and logical statement around tax revenue and how we can save dollars and how it affects law enforcement and how it affects our underserved communities. And so you really, depending on what button you want to push, you could really bring in a really diverse stakeholder group that can help champion this for you.
I have a question.
Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, this is Maggie Merritt with the Steinberg Institute. This is just such a great program, and I'm really interested about what your plan is after the 10 years.
Sure. So I think the hope is we're going to study how reimbursements work. So right now, no one will be turned away, so the tax will cover any of the costs that are not able to be billable. And our hope is in our community is with Medicaid expansion that more and more people will be covered and they will become billable expenses.
Great. Any additional questions for Jared on the line? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Going once, twice. All right. Well, thank you so much, Jared, and thanks for all the great work you guys are doing down in Baton Rouge, and stay safe with the incoming weather.
Awesome. Thank you. And if you guys have any follow-up questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to me or call. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared. Now for our second presentation today, we are thrilled to have with us Larez Meinhold, who serves as the Executive Director of Caring for Denver. Founded and funded by Denver, Caring for Denver Foundation was created on November 6, 2018, when 70% of Denverites turned it into a reality. The ballot initiative was simple, yet powerful. For every $100 spent in Denver, 25 cents, totaling over $30 million, depending on the status of the economy, goes toward addressing mental health and substance misuse needs in the city of Denver. The increased revenue will be used for mental health services, including suicide prevention programs, substance abuse treatment, prevention and recovery programs, facilities and programs for those with mental health diagnoses, and training for first responders. The goal of the program is to improve long-term recovery rates, reduce the use of substances, decrease homelessness, and take the burden of dealing with mental illness away from the courts and place it in the hands of treatment providers. And with that, I will turn the call over to Larez, who can walk you through the deep dive. Larez, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice, and the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate this opportunity to talk a little bit more about Caring for Denver. So Caring for Denver was really inspired by Representative Leslie Harriott. Even though she's a state representative, she represents a Denver district, and she was some of the driving force behind this initiated ordinance. It was 301 on the Denver municipal ballot, and it again is a 25% increase to the sales and use tax, so 25 cents on a $100 purchase, to address mental health and substance misuse needs in the city and county of Denver. And this came out of needs she heard in the community, as well as was fueled by her own experience. Representative Harrod saw firsthand what a lack of available services could do. Her sister has been in and out of the criminal justice system for at least 20 years, and a lot of it has really been around those mental health and substance misuse challenges. She never got the adequate care, and then it really, each, she never really had a shot each time to get out of the system. And it was really out of this desire to say, how do we do better? And similar to the last speaker, this was really about creating strong partnerships, and not just always with the traditional partners. So it was strong partnerships with providers and with folks in representing kids and adults and faith communities, but also arts community was a great partner in this effort, specifically the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver. They really wanted to get behind a measure that would change how the city relates to and treats the issue of mental health and substance misuse and suicide. High rates of mental health needs and substance misuse issues in the arts community. And so this was a way to really say, how do we support our community in this as well? It's flexible funding, a majority of it. Only a portion is designated, and it is in perpetuity. Caring for Denver is in part inspired by the mental illness and drug dependency sales tax in King County, which you'll get to hear more about later. We really ran the campaign largely through earned media, social media, to be honest, and it was really around strength-based storytelling. It's, you know, we know that stories inspire and connect us. They reveal our similarities. They honor our uniqueness and challenge our thinking and flaws. And we did stories in all kinds of ways, in art, music, spoken word, to really find that commonality, because everybody is impacted by mental health and substance misuse in our communities. And so on November 6th, as was said, 70% of Denverites said yes to doing more to support mental health and substance misuse needs in our city. There are a couple allocated portions, 10% for 2 years, which was directed to the city for facilities related to alternatives to jail, 10% to the city on an ongoing basis for alternatives to jail, and then 5% for us as a nonprofit to administer. So the ballot initiative actually had this, this creating a new nonprofit to really administer this fund, to act as an operate as a foundation so that we could be nimble to different needs. But the remainder of the funding, that 75% for 2 years and 85% beyond that, those priorities were really determined by the community itself. So the board was appointed, so we passed in November. The board was appointed in April of 2019, same time I was hired as the executive director. It's a 13-member board appointed by the mayor. He has 6 appointments, so it's the director. All of these are the director and or their designee, so I will just say the department. Human Services, the head of public health, the city attorney, the district attorney, the CEO of Denver Health, which is our public health institute in city and county of Denver, and then the CEO of the mental health provider for Denver, which is Mental Health Center of Denver. City Council appointed 5. They get to appoint a provider, a person with lived experience, someone representing youth, a business interested in mental health and substance misuse, and then somebody representing underserved communities. And then the final 2 appointments are made by the district attorney, and her appointments are really related to having experience in this alternatives to jail space, one sort of generally and one specifically for youth. So the board was appointed, seated in April 2019. We got a signed contract with the City and County of Denver in September 2019 to be the spending authority for these resources. And then between October and November, we engaged 1,600 residents to ask where they really wanted us to focus. We looked at the needs assessment as it related to the city, to Denver Health, to Kaiser, and then we really sort of, once we got those sort of 9 top issues, we changed them from system needs to individual needs. So how does this look to me as an individual, rather than how does this impact the city or how does this impact an institution? And then we had people vote on, didn't seek to get to consensus, but just said, what are your top 3 issues and why? And so we created a funding document, and I think Walter shared that with you all. If not, it's on our website, caringfordenver.org. But alternatives to jail, as it was designated for the city, we also opened it up to community. We know that in order to build sort of those connections, create those resources so that folks aren't really in and out of the justice system because of mental health or substance misuse. How do we increase diversion opportunities, make sure there's more access to services, and create sort of better connection of systems? We have given away about $9 million already in this alternatives to jail space. A couple of those grants to the city were STAR, which is our alternative R-Cahoots-like model. So if folks haven't heard, Cahoots is an Oregon model that sends out a paramedic and a mental health provider, or an EMT basic and a mental health provider, instead of police or first responders. And we also expanded our co-responder program. Again, mental health professionals riding along with police, as well as we added a cadre of case managers, so that not only do they have that one touch with a co-responder, but then the case managers can really get them connected to other services. Of the community awards we made, over 60% were made to organizations led by a person of color, really focused on peer and people with lived experience as running that, as helping run those programs and keeping people sort of on the path to recovery. Community-centered is really how do we have more solutions in the places we live, work, play, pray, trust. That's currently open right now. Youth is one of our funding areas, and youth we've defined as 0 to 26, because that's how community defines youth. It's, they don't divide it up in the different areas. But how do we build resiliency in youth? And then care provision. How do we make sure that care providers have the right training, culturally relevant, providing culturally relevant care, as well as their self-care for care providers? So those are our funding areas. As was said, we are giving away about $36 million from last year. This year, our revenue numbers will likely be down. But that is a little bit of caring for Denver in a nutshell. So I'm going to open it up for questions, because I do much better with that than just talking at you.
Thank you, Lorez. That was a great synopsis of all the work you guys are doing. Reminder, folks, if you have a question, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. I will kick things off here. Lorez, I think one of the very unique things about what you guys are doing is that you have a nonprofit foundation running the, basically taking the revenue and running with that, which I think is different than a lot of the other examples we've seen take place across the country. Can you talk about, like, what are some of the advantages to doing that in regards to the long-term just longevity of this program moving forward?
Sure. I think one, it gives us the ability to stay focused on mental health and substance misuse, regardless of who's elected mayor or city council. It gives us that long-term focus, ideally in partnership with both of those players, but irregardless, we have this dedicated source where we can really listen to community and meet community needs. It also, we're able to be a little more nimble. With COVID impacting mental health and substance misuse to great needs, we were able to get dollars out, close to, I want to say, $1 million out to community grassroots organizations and others serving folks as folks were being actively diverted from jails and other places. We were able to get money out within a month of sheltering in place. And so, again, that nimbleness really allows us to address and meet community needs. We still have an accountability to the city, both in our contract. We can be audited and are currently being audited by the city auditor, so that we're making sure we build systems that align and sort of follow the intent of the initiative itself.
Great. Any questions for Lorez and Lani? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Just give folks a second here. Lorez, additional question I have from my perspective is, can you talk about, especially going back to the campaign of this, just the overall importance that storytelling and community storytelling had on the success of the outcome?
Yeah, it's key. And again, if you guys get a chance to look at our website, you'll see that storytelling continues to be a part of who we are. We do it from a very strength-based. And again, so many people are impacted by mental health and substance misuse, whether it's themselves, their family member, their nieces, nephews, their community, who they teach, whatever that might be. Even as I was gathering signatures for the ballot initiative, it's always hard to get somebody to stop and sign. you know, after you say, are you registered to vote? And they're, and then you say, I am actually gathering signatures to fund mental health and substance misuse. And more than any initiative that I have ever collected signatures for, people would stop, turn around, and come back and say, we have to do something different. And really telling those stories from strength-based really lets me relate to, you know, whatever my experiences are, I can see that in somebody else's story. And it helps also reduce the stigma and really talks about how many people are impacted, how many youth are impacted, how many older adults are impacted, veterans are impacted. And you show the diversity of people impacted by mental health and substance misuse. People can see that. They see that in their lives, and then seeing that in a campaign helps them really understand how this money is going back to them and their community.
Great. Any questions for Lorez on the line? You could unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Give folks a second. And Lorez, one final question. I posed this question to Jared as well. If, you know, you guys obviously had a champion in Representative Herod, which I think is super important to have in doing stuff like this. But what advice would you have for a city or a county looking to do something similar and take this on?
Yeah, I think it's important to have the champions. And while Representative Herod was the most visible, it was also Carl Clark from Mental Health Center of Denver. It was Harry from the Asian Pacific Development Center. It was Adam Lerner from the Museum of Contemporary Art. And so having that diversity of leaders to really step up and talk about why it's important to them as well as their communities is a huge part of it. Again, and it makes it more person, people oriented and less systems oriented. It's so hard for people to see themselves in systems, but they can see themselves in people. And so again, if you're able to connect to people's experience, that's why we were able to pass with 70% of the vote.
Great. Well, Lorez, thank you so much for the comprehensive presentation and for all the great work you guys are doing out in Denver. We really appreciate it.
No, thanks for the opportunity. And again, I'd offer my email is Lorez@caringfordenver.org. And feel free, if there's questions or other things you want to know, reach out anytime.
Great. Thank you. And a reminder, everyone, we'll be sending out after the call everyone's contact info and presentation so folks can take an additional look. For our next presentation, we'll come from King County, Washington, who will be discussing their mental illness and drug dependence sales tax. And here to discuss that, we are happy to be joined by Sarah Wilhelm, who is the strategic advisor for trauma-informed systems at the Best Starts Kids Initiative. Joining Sarah will be Kelly Numora, Behavioral Health and Recovery Division Director at the King County Department of Community and Human Services, and Robin Foffman, MID Coordinator at the Behavioral Health and Recovery Division at King County Department of Community and Human Services. Just for some quick background, King County's MID tax is a countywide 0.1% sales tax, which generates about $136 million every 2 years, specifically for programs and services for people living with or at risk of behavioral health conditions. So I don't want to steal King County's thunder, so I will turn the call over to Sarah and the team from King County. And you guys, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice, and the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Walt. Can you hear me now? Am I unmuted?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. This is Sarah Wilhelm, and I'm just going to give a little bit of background and context about King County and our kind of revenue and political situation, and then turn it over to my colleagues, Kelly and Robin, to talk more specifically about our mental illness and drug dependency levy. So here in Washington State, we do not have an income tax, and so we have pretty significant challenges with revenue and support for social services at the state level that, of course, translates down to King County's general fund. King County, for those who might not be familiar, is the county that includes the city of Seattle. But beyond that, we're about roughly the size of the state of Delaware in terms of both geographic size and population. Very diverse county with very diverse needs. We have over 80 languages spoken. We have, of course, the urban center of Seattle as well as suburbs. And then we also have some pretty rural areas with their own unique challenges. We also have a relatively affluent and liberal population and voter base that has been supportive of supplementing our very limited state funds for mental health and well-being in a variety of ways. So before we talk about MID, we have two other major initiatives that I think really also support our county's limited basic mental health services to support the emotional well-being of communities. First is Best Starts for Kids, which, as Walt mentioned, is my home initiative. I work for Public Health Seattle and King County. Our health department does not provide behavioral health services. That is done by our Community and Human Services Department. But Best Starts for Kids is a nice cross-departmental example of collaboration between our two departments, where we can supplement those very important and critical direct services with some more upstream promotion and prevention efforts. That levy is a voter-approved property tax levy, a funding source and a policy framework that invests $65 million a year in holistic supports for children, young people, and families, with an emphasis, again, on upstream promotion, prevention, and early intervention. The vast majority of those funds are awarded to community-based organizations, including a pretty large number of organizations, small grassroots organizations, many run by BIPOC people, and many of whom have not received government funding in the past. So it's a very equity-focused initiative as well. And then the other initiative that I just wanted to mention is our Veterans, Seniors, and Human Services Levy, which also supports well-being for veterans, residents of King County age 55 or older, and other vulnerable populations with programs and services that help them live healthy, productive, and meaningful lives. And that levy supports things like affordable housing, job training, behavioral health treatment that's, again, focused on some of our most vulnerable populations, employment opportunities, and more. So you can learn more about those initiatives on our website, kingcounty.gov. And if you just look up Community and Human Services Department, you'll see right front and center links to those three levies that, again, we feel very fortunate to have. And also, we'll continue to hope for more sustainable and dedicated funding streams from the state and federal level as a ultimately more sustainable way of funding these really critical services for our communities. So with that, I want to turn it over to Kelly and Robin to talk more specifically about our MID initiative.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Kelly. I'm the Director of Behavioral Health for King County. And I'm going to just do a real quick background on our mental illness and drug dependency. So several years ago, King County recognized the need for additional mental health and substance use misuse programs due to the rising use of emergency services, incarceration, and homelessness throughout our communities. And we knew that we needed to fill gaps, funding gaps, that Medicaid could not fill. So in 2005, the Washington State Legislature created an option for the 39 counties in Washington State to support behavioral health services locally, giving them an option to increase local sales tax by 0.1% to augment state funding for behavioral health services and therapeutic courts. As required by the state law, revenue raised by MID needed to be used for new and expanded mental health and substance use disorder services, including therapeutic courts. Then in 2006, the King County Council began exploring the possibility of utilizing this tax option in response to some shrinking state investment in community-based behavioral health services and corresponding escalations in the use, as I said, of jails and hospitals for those living with behavioral health conditions. By 2007, after significant work with partners in our communities, and we heard from our other speakers how important bringing in partners from the communities on these efforts, the executive of King County and the King County Council authorized the levy tax, collecting to begin in 2008 and extending through 2016. So King County is one of 23 counties across the state that have now authorized the tax revenue. And in 2016, we are fortunate that the King County Council voted unanimously to extend our sales tax collection for MID once again through 2025. So some of the programs and services that we offer from the MID funds, there's about 50 different initiatives that are funded through these dollars. And we really try to, through the feedback and input of communities across King County, King County MID Advisory Committee, as well as various partners, really trying to make sure that we are providing these dollars across all age ranges, that we are identifying and supporting communities across King County. There's a significant, as was mentioned earlier, diversity in King County, and we really want to make sure that we're supporting those communities in ways that each community uniquely could use those funds. So we try to fund a continuum, everything from crisis services all the way to unique and necessary outpatient behavioral health services and residential services. So a couple of examples of some of the programs and services that we're funding with our MID dollars include school-based screening and intervention that promotes social and emotional health and also prevent substance use in all of the middle schools across Seattle and King County. We're also funding a geriatric crisis service that performs using community outreach, reaching the seniors in our communities and not having to have them come into the facilities for services. We're also funding a law enforcement assisted diversion program. The goal there is to reach individuals before they hit the criminal justice system. What services and supports do they need to keep them out of the jail and the criminal justice system? We're also funding a rapid rehousing voucher program, providing housing vouchers so that individuals in our community that are homeless or experiencing homelessness can access housing. We're funding behavioral health specific supported employment services, providing opportunities for those with behavioral health needs to find part-time and full-time employment in a city of Seattle where that can be very difficult. We're also funding community-driven behavioral health grants, again, putting the dollars into those specific communities and allowing them to come up with how they're going to spend those dollars specific to their unique community needs. And then final example is we're very much in support of those with lived experiences and peers in our community, so funding a peer bridger service that helps individuals discharge from state and local hospitals so that they can return to their community and have the support that they need. So those are just a few of the examples of the 50 different initiatives that the MID funds support and have supported over time. I'm now going to turn this over to Robin, who's going to give a little more information about the County Council and the different funding initiative strategy areas. Thanks for having us today.
Hi, Robin. I don't know if your line is muted, but you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice.
I wonder if she may also have her phone on mute.
Yep. Robin, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice.
Well, maybe in the, this is Sarah, maybe in the meantime
Actually,
we could take.
It's Robin.
Oh, there she is. Okay, great.
Hi, Robin.
I'm so sorry about that. I'm struggling over here. I'll just be really quick. There was just a couple other things that I wanted to add. One is just really, I think Kelly did a great job summarizing many of the different initiatives that you know that we fund. And I know we sent you our annual report, Walt, for last year. So hopefully you can send that, share that with your network. But just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the challenges we faced just with the COVID impacting our system here. And while it's been great and it's such a resource that we have the mental health, mental illness, drug dependency, behavioral health sales tax fund, when we're funding really critical services, impacts the sales tax like we've seen here it's very concerning and is problematic. And we've seen a fairly big dip in terms of our sales tax revenue and had to really work on budget negotiations within our different initiatives over the last several months to make sure everyone can continue to operate to the extent with as minimal impact as possible. I did want to just highlight two initiatives in particular that we've been able to leverage, and one that we do fund through the prevention and early intervention strategies is mental health first aid. And we've been able to leverage that actually working closely with Sarah Wilhelm's group to make sure that that resource is available to a larger number of communities of color throughout King County. And we've tested and piloted their online version. And that's something that we're hoping to continue to lift up as our community kind of struggles with the current status with COVID impacts in our community. The other piece I would just mention is LEAD, which is the Law Enforcement Assistant Diversion Program. They actually were able to leverage additional dollars, not solely mid-funding at all, but to adapt their model to a co-lead model, really leaning forward in communities that they serve, particularly with people living homeless, and making sure that they are continuing to get connected to housing resources, healthcare resources, testing, education around social distancing, and you know, connecting them to safe housing in hotels and whatnot, as we try to spread out our homeless population in King County. And so I just wanted to kind of just reiterate that while this funding has been great, the sales tax piece becomes a little bit challenging when we have this kind of unprecedented events such as COVID-19 hitting our community. So with that, I know we're a little over time, so I will stop.
No, Robin, actually on that point, could you actually talk about, and for folks online, we all know that, you know, various mechanisms, right? You have the income tax, you have property taxes, you have sales taxes. Can you talk about sort of the volatility of relying on a sales tax and obviously having, when you have, you know, sharp downturns in the economy, that, you know, how do you guys assess and deal with the sort of more, you know, climate-based, your economic climate-based situation to sort of fund various programs?
Well, I mean, I can tell you what we did this time. I've been in my position for 8 months. I know that during the 2008 downturn, there was also a similar process that they went through in terms of prioritization. We handled that differently this time. I actually met with each of the individual initiatives to really work at that level on how to negotiate. At that point, we were anticipating about a 25% reduction across the board within our initiatives. I met with individual program leads. We also have an advisory committee that Kelly mentioned, and we worked on prioritizing principles within that advisory committee, and equity and social justice actually very appropriately rose to the top. And so we, you know, really looked at also data evaluation as a big component of our work too, and trying to at least monitor how many people our programs have served, how well they did it, and kind of what program outcomes were. So we looked at a variety of different kind of inputs to kind of negotiate reductions, and we also got some new good news. Recently, the outlook, the budget forecast is actually a little bit better than we thought it would be. So we've been prepared for the worst and are happy to just be able to, you know, minimize. Certainly, it's still a big hit, but not as bad as we've been expecting.
Right. And then are there mechanisms in place in regards to, so that this is, you know, not siphoned off for just general fund purposes or other things? Is there legal mechanisms in place to make sure that this, the mid-tax just goes directly for mental and behavioral health services?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a strong commitment to behavioral health services in King County, so we're glad about that. And I think people recognize the cost savings of investment in these programs. I don't think we haven't struggled too much with that dynamic. I think with our community advisory committee, we do try to maintain transparency, and I think there will be people really speaking out if those issues were present. One of the things, too, that we're considering putting into place is sort of an equity cabinet within that advisory committee, just to provide a louder voice. Some of the things that we sometimes struggle with is just the power dynamics between community stakeholders that are part of that group, and then sort of governmental insiders and council members who are on part of that also group. So that's something that we're going to be working on over the next couple of years.
Great. And if there are any questions on the line for our friends from King County, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. I will just wait a second to see if anyone has any questions. And could you guys just talk about, because you know, there was obviously we've had, you know, numerous, a lot of these are done through ballot initiative. Did this come through a ballot initiative, or did it come down from the state allowing the county to you know, utilize a sales tax for these purposes?
Yeah, no, we are actually really lucky. Some of the initiatives that Sarah covered, Best Starts for Kids and the Veterans and Seniors and Human Services Levy, do require a ballot initiative and have to get support from the voters on our every 6 or 7 years. Ours really came down from the state. I think it was a reaction to a couple of different pressures that in some inadequacies and challenges in the, particularly around hospitalization and enough capacity within our community to be able to handle the number of inpatient beds and whatnot. And so I think that the state really moved forward to make this available to counties and communities, and King County took them up on it. And so just every 7 years, 6, 7 years, there just needs to be council approval to continue these dollars, and we don't feel the same pressures around making sure that, you know, in terms of that public buy-in related to supporting this initiative.
Great. And then before, last question from our end is, and this for the entire King County team is, as I asked Larez and Jared, you know, if you're a city or a county looking to, you know, to do something similar, where would you start?
Kelly, I don't know if you have, I'm not sure if you're still on the line. I know you had to go to another meeting. I would start, I mean, certainly people are welcome to connect with me, and I could connect with folks who might be more in the know in terms of what happened historically. There's people who've been working on our division for many years in the Behavioral Health Recovery Division that I could connect folks with. And also, you know, it's something to consider in terms of how we can kind of put a packet of together about how this came about and what tools and resources communities could be leveraging to replicate this model in their own states, because it's definitely has brought in some very much needed resources to King County.
Well, thank you guys. We really appreciate your work on this and taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry about my communication snafu there.
No worries at all. Now, moving on for our final presentation today, we're thrilled to have with us Maggie Merritt, who serves as the Executive Director of the Steinberg Institute in California, and Julie Snyder, Government Affairs Director for the Steinberg Institute as well. They are here to discuss the Mental Health Services Act in California, which was passed as a statewide ballot initiative, also known as Prop 63. And now Prop 63 imposed a 1% tax on people who earn more than $1 million annually to pay for expanded mental health care in California. Since its passage, it has generated more than $15 billion for counties in California to provide mental and behavioral health services. And with that, I will turn the call over to Maggie and Julie. And Maggie, the floor is yours. And you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice.
Thanks very much. Can you hear me?
We can.
You can?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So thank you, Walter. It's great to be here with you. And I want to also thank Julie Snyder for joining me on this call to provide any TA I may need. Just in case I forget anything, we're huge fans of Cities Thrive, so it's a real thrill to be here with you. I'll try to make our little summary a bit quick since we're low on time. I'll give you just a bit of history. So 40 years ago, the state of California shut down many state hospitals for people with severe mental illnesses without providing the adequate funding for community mental health services. So to address the urgent need for recovery-based and accessible community-based mental health services, our founder, Mayor Daryl Steinberg, who in 2004 was an assembly member, along with mental health community partners, introduced Proposition 63, which is also known as the Mental Health Services Act. So in California, the legislature and registered voters are able to place initiatives on the ballot. Proposition 63 was placed on the ballot by registered voters via signature collection. And back then, you were required to get a minimum of 373,816 signatures, which we did, and we got far more. But the initiative, once it was placed on the ballot, turned out to be the most controversial initiative on the ballot. You know, I think back in 2004, and even still today, but back in 2004, people just weren't acknowledging the need that was out there for people who are living with a brain illness. So we worked with all of the Mental Health Coalition members and first responders, police, fire, the teachers union, the medical association, a whole wide variety of stakeholders, and just really hit the pavement, really door to door. We did a lot of phone banking. Social media wasn't really a thing in 2004, and so we did it old school style for the most part. I ran the volunteer camp, and we were just out, you know, throughout California spreading the word about the need and about what the Mental Health Services Act would do if passed by the voters. So on November 2nd in 2004, Proposition 63 did pass with a 53.8% vote, yes vote, 46.2% voted no. So it was super close. So a little bit about Proposition 63. Proposition 63 places a 1% tax on personal income above $1 million. And since that time, it has generated a bit more than $15 billion. And actually in 2020, it brought in about $2.4 billion for mental health services. It provided the first opportunity in many years to expand county mental health programs for all populations including children, transition age youth, adults, older adults, families, and most especially the un and underserved. It was designed to provide a wide range of prevention, early intervention, and treatment services, including the necessary infrastructure, technology, and enhancement of the mental health workforce to support it. The mental health services was kind of cut into five components. And the first component is the community services and support. 80% of the funds are dedicated to what we refer to as CSS. And they are focused on community collaboration, cultural competence, client and family-driven services and systems, wellness focus with, which includes concepts of recovery and resilience, integrated service experiences for clients and family, as well as serving unserved and underserved. Housing is also a large part of the CSS component. And, you know, this component is also commonly referred to as the whatever it takes program. And it serves people living with serious mental illness. And currently about $1,920,000,000 is going toward our CSS program in California. The next program is focused on prevention and early intervention, and 20% of the funds are directed to this component. And it's helped to help counties implement services that promote wellness, foster health, and prevent the suffering that can result from untreated mental illness. It requires the collaboration with consumers and family members in the development of prevention and early intervention projects and programs. And approximately $480 million are directed toward the PEI program. And then 5%, counties are required to 5% from either their CSS or their PEI programs to focus on innovation. And innovation programs are to be used for to develop, test, and implement promising practices. And then the last two components are capital facilities and technological needs, and those funds are to be used to create facilities that are used for the delivery of services and for administrative offices. And then the workforce and education and training component is to develop a diverse workforce. So the MHSA funds are allocated to counties through a formula that weighs each county's need for mental health services, the size of its population most likely to apply for services, and the prevalence of mental illness in the county. Adjustments are made for the cost of living and other available funding resources. The formula also provides a minimum allocation to rural counties for the CSS and PEI components. So that's kind of Prop 63 in a nutshell, and I'd really like to talk just a minute about kind of lessons learned over the last 15 years. I want to start by just saying that counties are doing phenomenal work. I mean, I could talk all day about the work behavioral health directors are doing in California. I mean, it's literally heroic. It's just mind-blowing. So that said, though, the way things are going, what we have is 58 counties doing things 58 different ways. And because we don't have clear data, we don't know enough about our outcomes. So we're not able to tell the full story of the MHSA. So in 2019, we spent the bulk of the year bringing together stakeholders to just ask the question, if you could update the Mental Health Services Act, what would you do? And by and large, everyone that we spoke to, all the groups, said that what we need is a bold vision, committed leadership, and clearly defined objectives. And the major things that arose out of this year-long work was that we needed stronger state leadership, particularly regarding outcome measures and accountability, while preserving and enhancing county flexibility over implementation. We needed opportunities to connect the MHSA to substance abuse services, housing, and criminal justice systems that serve overlapping populations, and the potential to impact larger reforms through the Medi-Cal, Medicaid, as you know it, Medicaid waiver renewals, and to allow for a stronger leveraging of Medicaid dollars, and the need to clarify and revamp the role of, we have an entity called the Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission, which is directed to oversee the MHSA, and they're just kind of in this weird position in the state. And they don't really have a lot of power over the entire MHSA. The Department of Healthcare Services really has the bulk of that power. And we have been lacking strong leadership at the Department of Healthcare Services, which is actually currently changing under our new governor. The final two proposals or suggestions to update is we need to scale up and model, we need to scale up model programs across the state. Again, we have 58 counties doing 58 different things, and we really need to standardize care with best practices across the state. So, and instead of, and the final, and I think a really important piece is instead of having defined components like CSS, PEI, innovation, et cetera, we really feel that instead we need to create an outcomes framework. We need to get rid of this kind of 80-20 split of the funds and create an outcomes framework instead so that counties would be required to report on the following: the reduction of homelessness, increased diversion from the criminal justice system and reduced police interactions and incarceration, reduced emergency room visits and hospitalizations, and reduced suicide. So, and then if we did it this way, given each county is very unique, counties would need to report annually as to how they use their MHSA funds to meet these goals. And if they did not meet these goals, the state would provide technical assistance to help these counties to better meet these goals. So, you know, there's just so much more I could say, but I think I want to leave it here since we're a little bit out of time, we're past time, and open up for any questions.
Great. Thank you, Maggie. If you have a question online, you can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Just one quick thing for me, Maggie. You talked a little bit about the funding formula, and I'm assuming that, you know, L.A. County gets a lot more than, say, like Santa Cruz County. Could you just talk a little bit about what goes into that funding formula and how the state distributes that the MHSA money?
Oh, God, that's the most convoluted aspect of this whole thing. Let's see. Well, as I said, they really do take into consideration the population and kind of other funding that counties have access to. But I would say primarily it's based on population. And then the funds are distributed to each of the 58 counties. And then counties have, they make their own decisions about how they're going to, you know, spend those funds as it relates to the five components. Once the county makes a plan, that plan needs to be presented to their board of supervisors who needs to approve it. And then they submit the plan to the Department of Healthcare Services for review and approval. With regard to the innovation funds, that is another aspect of the MHSA. Counties need to get approval for their innovation projects from the Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission. And this is the component that the commission really has kind of some say about. And it, at this moment, counties would say that it's a very cumbersome process. They spend a year or more creating an innovation plan, you know, coming up with something that's never been done before. And then they travel, you know, all the way across the state to Sacramento, where the commission is, and they have 3 minutes to present their plan to the commission, and it's either approved or not. And if it's not approved, they have to go back and try it again. And so I don't know, some of you may have heard about or seen some of the press around unspent MHSA funds in California. It was close to $1 billion at one point. That's gone down significantly now, I think closer to about $250 million. But a big portion of the funds that were unspent came from this innovation component, primarily because I think really it's just they've got so much on their shoulders, it's hard to kind of get creative and dig in and come up with an innovation plan. But once you do that, you then have to go through this very cumbersome process after having gotten support and, you know, approval from your board of supervisors. You then need to go to the commission for approval, which is sometimes is very unclear as to what the commission uses to make their determination. But anyway, so unspent funds were largely innovation funds and prevention early intervention funds.
Great. Anyone on the line have a question for Maggie? You can unmute your line by hitting the star button twice. Just give folks a second. And Maggie, it's funny you mentioned the innovation portion of the MHSA. We actually had our conference last year. We actually highlighted a program that came out of that innovation side from Ventura County.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. One additional question I have is, have you guys seen, since it is a millionaire, a tax on millage, have you guys seen big fluctuations in regards to funding from year to year, or has it been pretty steady?
We have seen fluctuations. Actually, I can give you a sense of that. So in 2005, when, you know, during our first year, we brought in just $254 million, so very little. But, and then moving into 2005-2006 fiscal year, we brought in $906 million. And then moving over to 2009 and 10, we brought in $1.3 billion. And then in 2011, we all know what happened around that time, we were bringing in only $849 million. So it was quite a significant drop. It came back up in 2014-15 at 1.8, and right now we're bringing in about $2.4 billion. Though with COVID, we are expecting a decrease. We're losing millionaires. And so we are not sure what that decrease will be. But, you know, it is, I'm looking at my numbers right now. For the most part, it has stayed over $1 billion since 2009. You know, there has been fluctuations. So counties need to be careful to braid funding so that, you know, their programs aren't only reliant on the MHSA. And then they also have their prudent reserves that they need. You know, they can keep up to 33% of the MHSA funding for prudent reserves.
Okay. All right. And then just one final question I had, and it's, and obviously it's different, the MHSA is different than the rest of the programs that we highlighted just because it's statewide, and just, and you guys were sort of the first ones through the wall on this. Could you talk about just the distinct challenges, especially running, you know, a statewide campaign ballot initiative on this, and not to mention the fact just how diverse California is. Can you talk about some of the challenges and maybe some just best, you know, if you had to give someone, you know, a best practice to follow if they were looking to do something similar, at least locally?
Yeah, well, I think we were in a different year or a different world in 2004 as it relates to, you know, how we ran the campaign back then versus how we would run another campaign, which we are considering in terms of updating the MHSA. Originally, we thought we might go to the ballot this year, but, you know, the pandemic had other plans, and our budget went from, I think we had a $6 billion excess of funds down. Now we have $54 billion deficit, so couldn't go in for more money this year. But I think the primary rule of thumb in this world is to engage early and engage everyone to really ensure that consumers, health providers, parents, families, first responders, the police, the sheriffs, the firefighters, the medical association, the schools, everyone needs to have skin in the game. And as we all know, when it comes to brain health, whether it's mental illness or substance use disorder, you know, it impacts all of us. So our mode of operation would be to identify all the different stakeholder groups and to begin engaging with them in a very deliberate way to hear about what they are needing and where services are lacking and how we could improve things moving forward.
Well, that's great and incredibly comprehensive, Maggie, and we really appreciate you taking the time for all your work on this issue for as long as you've been doing it. So we appreciate your presentation.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
I want to thank all of our speakers for taking the time out of their days to come to speak with us today. As been said on this call, I will make sure that everyone has the presentations and any background materials necessary should anyone want to look more into this. I'll also be sending around the call recording later this afternoon. Should you have any additional questions or want further information from anyone you heard from today, you can email me directly at wbishop@cityhall.nyc.gov. Our September call will take place on Tuesday, September 22nd from 2:15 to 3:15 p.m. Eastern, and we will talk to you all then. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks very much.